Hello, and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Today, we have a sermon by Pastor Jason Gerlach.
It's Memorial Day weekend, which kicks off the summer travel season. Fridays in June, July, and August are the busiest travel days of the year in the United States. Select any one of them, and you've selected a day of greater nationwide travel than even the day before Thanksgiving, which many assume is the busiest day of the year. The season of summer travel has begun. I'm reminded of this when in conversation with high school seniors anticipating their upcoming graduation, summer trips, educational or gap year plans for the fall. Those conversations take me back to the same time in my own life when I learned of an opportunity in Central Java, Indonesia. Were I to push pins with yarn in a map, at that time in my life, from there I'd be able to track how one decision led to another, from Central Java to Harrisonburg, from afternoon conversational English and Bahasa Indonesia classes, where together Agung, Eddie, Susanti, and I guided each other through the ins and outs of practical language choices to a more permanent pursuit of congregational ministry with children, youth, and young adults. Little did I know that one decision years ago, heart opened to all of the possibilities that would transpire from that point forward, that it would guide my life through one transition after another. Similarly, I've recently held premarital counseling sessions with three couples who will be married this summer. The sessions have centered around the results from the Prepare Enrich instrument, building communication skills, learning as a couple to make financial decisions, planning the wedding ceremony, and discussing the upcoming transitions of living arrangements and the commitment they are making to one another. There are yet more venues in which I've heard about upcoming transitions. The Dean House Voluntary Service Unit Committee has heard from both Ali Zerker and Liza Brenneman that they will conclude their time at the organizations they are serving and move out of the Dean House this summer to pursue graduate school opportunities this fall. So our committee has been in conversation with four college graduates who expressed some level of interest in our voluntary service location. We're still awaiting a commitment for next year, as those four individuals have, for a variety of reasons, decided not to join the unit. One was offered a lab technician position at UVA. Another selected AmeriCorps as her volunteer organization. Another will begin a role as resident director at Mennonite College in this fall. And the fourth expressed a pressing need to save money toward further schooling opportunities. On Tuesday, I heard senior track teammates pass along nuggets of wisdom to the members of the team who will return next year. Things like, if your coaches demand a hard workout with lots of sprints, give it your all. You'll see the reward at the end of the season. Or, another senior piped up, you can throw discus and shot put, and you'll never have to do any of those hard workouts. The remaining seniors encouraged their teammates to try out new events, to spread encouragement around, and to get to know all teammates equally. The track team had congregated together after the school-wide sports reception took place, in which many heartfelt goodbyes were expressed for an athletic director who'd served the school faithfully for 22 years. I've also heard transition comments in conversation about CMC's conference affiliation decision, and in conversations with people who move back to Harrisonburg soon after years abroad, or those who've committed to stay in their current work setting for yet one more year, but then seek out other vocational opportunities. And the current members of our catechism class are assessing whether their next step will be to join the church. Many have expressed their questions about upcoming transitions by saying something along the lines of, "What does it all mean? I wonder." Or we're asking ourselves, "What's next?" And I haven't even mentioned MCUSA's biennial convention or the many trips that members of this congregation are leading to Jerusalem, Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, Guatemala, to name a few. Some summer trips will go smoothly. Others will experience challenges. Now, I don't know this, but the Apostle Paul, he traveled a lot. And as recorded in Acts 16, 6 through 8, which comes directly before this morning's passage, the text says Paul and Timothy wanted to travel broadly, but they couldn't. Listen to the text. They went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. It also says, when they had come opposite Mysia, they attempted to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them so. Passing by Mysia, they went down to Troas. Let's track their version. You heard that they had been in Phrygia and Galatia and had hoped to head over to Asia, but it wasn't allowed. So in turn, they ended up in Mysia and had hoped to go to Bithynia, but it wasn't allowed. So they are currently stuck in Troas, which is right about here. According to the text, Paul and Timothy stumble around the region, running into one barrier after another, barred by the Spirit from going south and west into Asia or from going north into Bithynia. They appear backed into a coastal corner of Troas by God's repeated declarative statement, "No." These earlier verses, if included in this week's lectionary reading, remind us that God is in charge of this mission, that the church sometimes searches for God's calling in mistaken directions, and that God's Spirit speaks into what humans consider to be frustrating and difficult times of discernment. It isn't until Paul experiences a night vision that his next steps become clear. Spurred on by a dream, Paul is called to travel across the sea to search out a Macedonian man beckoning for him to come over to Macedonia and help us. So they set off, three dudes on a boat at night. Paul, Silas, and Timothy. Let's check in on their progress. Allow me to back up. Paul received the vision alone, but as recorded in verse 10, the vision had to be interpreted by someone other than Paul. Listen, when he had seen the vision, we immediately tried to cross over to Macedonia, being convinced that God had called us to proclaim the good news to them. Interpretation requires more than one person, and it is at this point in the story that the communal us-we language enters in. There are two possible explanations. One, Did the narrator transition from eyewitness to participant, seemingly swept up in the moment? Or two, did the author select communal we language as a narrative technique so that readers of Luke Acts could assess their place in the story? Whatever the case, the language choice confirms that Paul and others felt God was using the Macedonian dream man to bring about immediate action. Preachers were needed in Macedonia. Go. Formerly, the message was no. Now it's go. Although I find the night vision as God's call curious, it is not as curious to me as the fact that there's no further mention of the Macedonian man. Once in Macedonia, he seems to be forgotten. Instead, Paul, Silas, and Timothy hang out for some time, and then later meet a woman named Lydia. She was one of several women who gathered at a place of prayer on the Sabbath, possibly the site of a future synagogue. A few days ago, I didn't know much about Lydia, nor the town of Tyrethia. But in researching the person and place, as well as consulting with Pastor Jennifer, here's the piece of information that I found most relevant. Despite much political unrest, power grabs, and the uncertainty and disillusionment experienced when empires were overthrown around her, Lydia held on to her cultural backgrounds and distinctiveness. If we traced her family lineage, we'll find ancestors who lived during the reign of Cyrus the Great and the Persians after they defeated the Lydian capital of Sardis. Other ancestors would have lived through the period of time when the Greeks ruled the area. And still other ancestors lived under Roman rule. Despite all these cultural machinations, Persian, Greek, Roman, Lydian culture wasn't completely erased. Interestingly, Lydia's own name serves as a cultural identifier for people from a specific region. Her name, Lydia, signifies a place of origin rather than a personal name, which suggests she may have been a former slave. But at the point of Acts 16, she's a free woman who works with textiles, purple textiles to be exact. And this detail about purple textiles counters what I just shared about her being a former slave. So how do we resolve these disparities? Aligning what we know that Lydia worked with purple textiles and that the city of Lydia was in Thyatira, we can assess that her status may have been more like well-to-do householder than former slave. Thyatira was an important center of the wool trade. A guild of wool workers is mentioned in an old inscription, and other inscriptions name several dyers and fillers in and around Thyatira, as well as the neighboring cities of Laodicea, Hierapolis, and Colossae. Now, before I continue on, may I highlight a few more things. Though Paul and Silas and Timothy apparently waste little time getting to the Macedonian city of Philippi, they are required to wait. Not much happens for a while. Patiently waiting, they were there for some days. Just how long, we're not sure. The appeal in the night vision seemed urgent, and their response to it was immediate. But the results, we don't see right away. When God does begin to work in Philippi, it comes with a surprise. Paul's vision had involved a Macedonian man, but the first to welcome the gospel in Philippi was a woman from the area Paul had just left. Lydia had also traveled by boat to Macedonia, possibly along the same route as Paul, Timothy, and Silas. She was transient, just like them. Simple explanations about God's mission are clearly going to be wrong. How odd and grace-filled that this woman from Thyatira in Asia where the Spirit had forbidden Paul to go, is now the one they meet in Philippi. In Acts 16, 9 through 15, I'm struck by the humility of the characters, wandering, waiting, respecting cultural, religious, and societal practices while drawing near to people, talking, befriending, accepting hospitality. I'm struck by it until I'm not. What I mean is that I'm struck by it until I read one phrase in the text. It's a qualifying phrase, which explains that Lydia was a worshiper of God. When I read the phrase, I feel confounded. Now, I know why the phrase is included in the narrative. I know that it identifies her as Jewish. I get it. But to me, it stands out when compared to the humility and respect throughout all other parts of the passage. Why include it? Is this a distinction Paul, Silas, and Timothy readily look for, whether a person was Jewish or not? Possibly. Or was it included for those who would hear of their travels? Does it help signify something in the post-resurrection world, I wonder? Does it function to distinguish between what is or was not Christian? And does that distinction carry with it some form of judgment? Does it tidy up a question of Christian identity, former versus present, and function similarly to the times Paul asks about the character of Christian lives, about the shape that Christian practices take in order to prevent the breakup of Christian community along lines that follow between Jewish and Gentile practice, or between upper and lower class lifestyles and privileges, or between those who continue to eat meat offered to idols and those who do not? Does it function to distinguish an alternative society, a special kind of club? Theologian Catherine Tanner points out that because of several complicating factors, Christian identity simply cannot be secured as a sharp cultural boundary. She provides the following reasons. One, it's rarely clear on what side the boundary something falls. Say the boundary is supposed to mark a sharp religious difference. Christian practices gain their identity as religious practices that exclude those of other religion. Still up for grabs is whether any of the practices at issue are religious or not. And two, where the boundaries are drawn is never fixed. Social practices that are excluded at one time and place are included at others. The reason the phrase "a worshiper of God" stood out to me is because it functions differently than the rest of the passage. Again from Tanner, although all that seemed relevant about another way of life was that it was not Christian, the missionary impulse in Christianity tended to work against dichotomous typification, against a "they are all one way and we are all another way." Heralded should be Paul, Silas, and Timothy's openness of heart to God's mission and guidance. However, when retelling their journey, they noted the boundary Lydia traversed. Once she was not part of us, now she's included. I ask again, was this information necessary? For whom was it included? Were a similar story to happen today, would it have been included? I wonder. As Tanner notes, this suggests, contrary to the influential views of H. Richard Niebuhr, that in the Christian case, relations with the wider culture are never simply ones of either accommodation on the one hand, or opposition and radical revision on the other, but always some mixture. A number of years ago, three friends and I spent a week toward the end of summer traversing the states of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. During the trip, we sought out local swimming holes and used bookstores. We hiked the Long Trail. We swatted flies in Bar Harbor. We staked out J.D. Salinger's residence. We ascended Mount Washington. We ate Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia ice cream. At Mount Washington's peak, we headed toward the visitor center, along with many others. We were thirsty, Even more, we were uncertain about the time. Our campsite for that evening wasn't nearby, and we guessed it to already be late afternoon. We felt pressed to begin our return trip down the mountain and to our campsite. At the visitor center entrance, we met up with a family of four. We held the door for them, or they for us, I can't remember. What I do remember is that one of us asked the father if he could tell us the time. He told us by turning his wristwatch in our direction. We thanked him and went on our way. Innocuous, right? Nothing to it. We were all summer visitors to a national landmark before the proliferation of cell phones as time-telling devices. It would be innocuous if there wasn't more to the story. 3 days later, we checked into a youth hostel in Portland, Maine, just before dinner time. Together, we decided that this would be the evening we'd eat at a restaurant, as the next day, we were headed to Bar Harbor, where we had reserved a campsite for our final nights. We asked the youth hostel caretaker for restaurant suggestions. He gave us some suggestions. Two nearby weren't bad, he claimed, but his favorite was a little further away and well worth the walk. As it happens, with a group of friends, three of us wanted one restaurant location, the other did not. In time, we found ourselves walking across town aimlessly, still undecided about which restaurant to choose. We rounded a street corner, and I took note that we were walking toward a family. A block separated us, but they were headed our direction on the same side of the street, so the distance was narrowing. All of a sudden, I knew that I knew these people. I nudged my friend and asked him, "Is that the family we met at Mount Washington?" He looked and nodded. As we neared the family, we stepped onto the street shoulder to allow them to stay on the sidewalk. But as we did so, my friend called out to the father, "Can you tell us the time?" The father stopped and looked at us. His face changed numerous times over. Surprise, perplexity, fear. They had recognized us. This time, we introduced ourselves, explained our trip. They did the same. We tried to convince them that we weren't following them. But when we had recognized them along that street a second time, my friend said, "I had to ask the same question. We had to relive it, the same as we had done at the Mount Washington Visitor Center." It made for a very awkward time. Eventually, we laughed it off and then went our separate ways. At the restaurant, my friends and I talked about it throughout the rest of the meal. Many years later, I wonder what the family thought of us. Was it something they dismissed as coincidence? Did they feel at the time or since that we had had ulterior motives? As much as it's unsettling to meet someone in an unfamiliar context, many of us have had similar experiences. Just like that. We can be visiting a foreign country and meet someone from our hometown. Or other times, it takes no more than 5 minutes to figure out via some version of 6 degrees of Mennonite Kevin Bacon that we know each other, or that our grandparents knew each other. We could all share similar stories. But I can't shake this experience. It's one that I think about often. I don't know how to feel about it or its probability. Should we have, in the moment, even acknowledged their presence or let the opportunity pass? Should we have been open to something even more, inviting them to dinner, or telling them the details about the remaining days of our trip so that together we could assess if we'd overlap a third time? God's grace finds us where we are. When we hold onto dichotomous boundaries unaware of how they cause harm, or when we feel we've missed an opportunity to befriend other people, not only once, but twice, possibly causing uncertainty or fear, when we are distant, God is near. And God's grace finds us amidst upcoming transitions. This morning's passage shows that along life's circuitous route, God is in charge of God's mission. God sets its direction, and God determines its results. But the characters responded to God's mission with their hearts opened. Paul, Silas, and Timothy were open to shifting their travel itinerary. Lydia was open to listening to Paul, Silas, and Timothy. Lydia's household was open to joining her in baptism, and Paul, Silas, and Timothy warmly received Lydia's hospitality. These characters opened their hearts to God's work. God's grace found them where they are. And God's grace finds us today as we are. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.